Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
Hey, it's Laura Kanoy. The midterm elections are Tuesday, November 6th, and we want to emphasize this is a general election, so you don't need to change your party affiliation to vote for Republicans, Democrats, or Libertarians. They're all on the ballot. You just choose who you want. If you have more questions, go to our website, nhpr.org. There's an extensive voter guide there. And thanks. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. NHPR's Civics 101 team is here, our podcast refresher course on our democracy. The show has just completed a six-part series on the history of the midterms and why they matter. And it turns out there are many aspects of these elections that are seldom considered or appreciated, from all those local offices at the bottom of the ticket to what's really behind the ballot initiatives facing voters in many states. Today in The Exchange, we fathom the meaning and the mechanics of the midterms, and let's get your questions in. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Nick Capodice, Education Outreach and Engagement Producer and co-host of Civics 101. And Nick, really nice to see you.
Lovely to see you this morning, Laura.
Also with us, Hannah McCarthy, Producer and co-host of Civics 101. And Hannah, thank you for being here.
It is a pleasure to be here.
So, Nick, before we jump into sort of the ins and outs and what you guys learned about the midterms doing this work, what's the approach that you and Hannah try to take in unpacking the midterms?
Well, Civics 101 at its heart, neither Hannah or I are civic scholars by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever. We try to go into each episode with nothing as assumed knowledge, that the listener may have no knowledge of the most basic tenets of how our democracy works. And that way, no one is ashamed to learn about things that, like I had, frankly, a bit of a shabby civics education as a young boy. And everything I've learned about how our democracy works has been working on this show. So if you're someone who's maybe a little bit embarrassed about a lack of knowledge about our civic process, our democratic process, that's what our show is for.
Yeah, sometimes I get basic questions. Why aren't the U.S. senators on the ballot this year? Well, because they have six-year terms and they rotate, but that's a good question. Hannah, what's the sort of philosophy that you adopted approaching this project?
Well, we started with this idea that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily think the midterms do matter. Voter turnout is a lot lower. It's not a presidential race. It's not as exciting. There's none of the glitz and glamour. And we wanted to create a mini series basically explaining exactly why the midterms do matter. It has a lot to do with state and local elections. And while that might seem small, it actually ends up having a massive impact on your day-to-day life. And midterms also end up infusing Congress with new ideas and new people. So we really just wanted to reinforce, you know, it is important to pay attention to these things because they are going to have an impact on you.
Well, and that's an important point. And Nick, to you too, you know, make the case to people who just might not bother to vote on Tuesday that they kind of should.
Yeah, well, the first thing is that people are banking on you not voting on Tuesday.
Wait, people are banking
people
on
are
me
banking on
not
you not voting.
Voting.
Right. So certain legislation is put forward knowing that right now, stereotypically, a older, more conservative, whiter group is electorate is going to be voting in the midterms because fewer people care about the midterms. So policy will be put forward that is more suited to those people, to those
that's who turns out in midterms, older, whiter, more conservative.
Yeah, and as a result, people do not campaign for the youth as much during a midterm election because they won't turn out and vote. However, that said, this election is something new. This election coming out, I just read this morning that early voters, young early voters in Texas are 500% more than they have been in the past. So you never know what's going to happen in 2018.
Well, and sort of mathematically, Hannah, it almost seems like if fewer people are voting, my vote Laura Kanoi's vote counts even more, right? Because there's fewer people in the pool.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. I mean, you're a big fish in a tiny pond in this case, right? So you are able to really, you know, be heard in this midterm election.
Well, as you said, Hannah, in addition to U.S. House and a third of the Senate, tons of local offices are decided that might end up mattering more to your daily life. And we'll definitely talk about those a little bit later. So why do people, Nick, sit it out during the midterms?
Oh, well, I think people sit it out in the midterms because it seems like sort of a low affair. These small offices aren't as big. They don't have the glitz and glamour of a presidential election. And as a result, everybody during presidential elections is focused on the president. What is he doing? During a midterm election, though, this is a time when people and parties can sort of redefine themselves and bring out some new ideas. So if people are thinking of sitting it out, think that the midterms are a perfect excuse for a party to re-identify itself.
Again, the number for you to join us here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, a midterm elections 101. NHPR's Civics 101 team is here, having just completed a 6-part series on the history, mechanics, and meaning of the midterms. Check out their podcast. You can find a link at nhpr.org/exchange. Also, there's a voter guide there with information about registration, polling places, voters with special needs or situations. You can join us right now with your questions. As Nick said, no question is too large or too small, and there are no stupid questions. So do call in with the questions that you've always had about the midterm elections. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, both of you, it is said so often that it's almost cliche, but here goes. The midterms are a referendum on the president, even though he's not on the ballot. And one of your favorite civics analysts, Keith Hughes, says the president's party almost always loses congressional seats in the midterms. Let's hear.
Except for 1998. Bill Clinton was lucky enough to have a really good economy, and George Bush in 2002, and I'm thinking 9/11 might have had something to do with that. But every other election, whether it be Barack Obama or it be Bush or Nixon, or we can go way back to Harry Truman, usually Americans that are going to turn out want to see a constitutional republic that works. And usually that means that the president who's in power, like I said before, is going to take it on the chin.
That's Keith Hughes from Hip History, again in NHPR's Civics 101 series on the midterms. Nick, why is it that the president always takes it on the chin? I mean, Keith explained it, but I'd love to hear from you, too.
Sure. Well, there's a couple things. One of these things is an expression that neither Hannah and I have really heard about, but the concept of surge and decline, which basically is that if a ton of people are whipped up to come in to vote for the president during a presidential election, during the midterms, those people are going to stay home. People who...
Because they got what they wanted.
They got what they wanted. They're going to stay home. So the president will almost always take it on the chin. And also, this is sort of a check of the president's administration. Like, how am I doing, folks? Am I doing good? Am I doing poorly? And that's the reason why one of our midterm scholars, Andy Bush, we haven't been able to sneak him into an episode yet, but he's tremendous.
He's fantastic.
He said that if you look at major things that happened in American history, like the New Deal or the Great Society, these are bracketed by midterm elections, not by presidential elections. After the president's elected, they're just trying to, you know, stay in office for, you know, for another 6 years. But the 2 years after that, that's when stuff gets done.
Were you surprised to learn that, Hannah, that the president's party always takes it on the chin, as Keith Hughes put it?
I don't know that I'd ever really thought of a midterm election that way, but it does make sense if you look at the results of a midterm election. But it's also the sense that the president has been in office for 2 years and the American people are thinking to themselves, is this person giving me what they promised me I could have? And they're 2 years in, and I may be feeling a little bit disillusioned, a little bit dissatisfied. And those people who are paying enough attention are the same people who are actually showing up and voting. And so those are the people who are going to maybe put that check on the president.
So the president's not on the ballot, as we've said, but members of Congress are every 2 years and 1/3 of the Senate. And when the when you are a member of the same party as the president, sometimes you've got a little bit of work to do because, as we just heard from Keith Hughes, the president's party often takes it on the chin. I want to play a little clip from politics professor Barry Burden in your series discussing how politician from the sitting president's party in a midterm, how they focus their appeals to voters.
So members of the president's party tend to want to make elections about local issues and about them as people. So they want to emphasize what political scientists call the personal vote, reminding constituents in the district who they are as an individual, often kind of identifying with constituents, reminding them that, hey, I grew up here, or I share values with you, or I've been working for you in Washington, or I share the same goals as you. So I'm not really part of that Washington establishment. Lots of members of Congress and challengers actually run for Congress by running against it. They criticize the institution and try to convince voters that they will be the ones to go to Washington and help clean up the mess.
Again, that's politics professor Barry Burden talking to NHPR's Civics 101 team. Anything else you want to add on to that, Nick?
Oh, well, this is more of
running
Hannah.
Against the office that
you're
running
against
for.
The office that you're running for. Hannah, how many political ads do you think you watched when we made this episode?
At this point, I've watched hundreds.
Hundreds.
I'm sure
hundreds.
Of that.
Hundreds.
Yeah,
really?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow, gold star.
Yeah, and when you think about when you compare the ads for presidential campaign elections versus midterms, did you notice anything in particular that people said in midterm ads?
Yeah, if you are, so what we call the out party, in this case that's the Democratic Party, not the party of the president, they are running these sweeping melancholic ads that are basically pointing to like the terrible state of the nation right now, and they are really banking on the fact that people are feeling dissatisfied with the president. And then in the reverse, you've got the GOP running these ads that are pretty positive and are trying to reflect on how much work they've done in office, if they're incumbents, or how much work they will continue to do. It's actually pretty rare to find an ad where someone is saying, although I have found them, you know, Trump and I love each other very much, and that's why I'm running. And that will work in certain regions, but for the most part, you have to run on this referendum principle.
Yeah, sometimes running away from the president and then running back to the president a few years later. It's this beautiful, delicate dance that you see.
Yeah, someone you interviewed, Nick, I think, mentioned that in 2010, I think it was, many members of Congress, Democrats, said to President Obama, who now is campaigning for Democrats in these midterms, right, please don't come to my district.
Yeah, don't come to my district. And you see that happening with President Trump as well. You know,
yeah.
You know,
with other presidents.
And with
the
other
past,
presidents.
President
let's
Bush
just,
and so
you know,
forth.
Let's just keep it about me and local. And even the ads will say things like, here are my political endorsements. None. You know, and there's a lot about guns and there's a lot about local. These are the tropes that you see in midterm election campaign ads.
Kind of insulting. I'm trying to put myself in the position of the president. You know, hey, Nick, I'd like to come campaign for you. This is President Kanoy. And you say, no thanks, Laura. Really, I'm whatever day you can come, I'm busy that day.
I'm running as far as possible.
Yeah. Let's go to our listeners, both of you. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the history, the mechanics, the meaning of the midterms with NHPR's Civics 101 team. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Cheryl in Concord. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a question. I'm one of those people that don't usually vote in the midterms, but I have done a little research, and you know, I know that I'm registered as a Republican, but would like to vote Democratic. What do I have to do in this midterm to be able to do that? At this point, I know I'm past a point of changing my registration, but on poll day, what do I need to do?
Well, and Cheryl, sort of good news and bad news for you. Nick and Hannah really looked at the history and the mechanics of the midterms in general. Their show is a national show, actually. They just told me before we went on the air, they have more listeners in California than in New Hampshire. So they can't answer your question, but our website probably can, Cheryl. So I would really strongly advise you to go to nhpr.org/exchange. And because we are talking about the midterms on today's show, we've got a voter guide there with information about registration, polling places, voters who may have special needs or special situations. So please go to our website, Cheryl. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Lots of information there for you. And I'm really glad you called. And I really do hope you vote because, as Nick and Hannah told us, a lot of people don't vote in these midterms, which seems crazy to me because I'm kind of a politics geek. But Cheryl, I really hope that you can make it work and that you can vote. Grace also asked us a question. She sent us an email. She says, please discuss the two ballot questions and their ramifications so voters will have time to understand the impact of their yes or no votes. And we do have two constitutional amendments on the ballot this time in New Hampshire. Kind of unusual, Nick, right? Usually New Hampshire doesn't have all these.
Yeah, New Hampshire doesn't have as many. We did an episode on propositions, which is ballot initiative, referendum, and recall. What we have in New Hampshire right now is a legislatively referred constitutional amendment, and that's when the legislature throws it to the people to decide. We also have a unique thing in New Hampshire. We have an automatic ballot referral every 10 years. Should we have another constitutional convention in New Hampshire? Which I think is lovely, but you say that doesn't happen very often, right?
No, it doesn't happen.
It hasn't happened in a good long while.
It has not happened in a good long
while.
But
so these two questions, which actually this is one thing we can tell you to do, is to go and read those two questions. You can go to a site. We use Ballotpedia a whole lot, ballotpedia.org, and you can read the text of those two measures, those two amendments on your upcoming New Hampshire ballot.
Well, and if you've got 5-10 minutes, Grace, you can also, again, go to nhpr.org. And Morning Edition host Rick Ganley did an interview today and yesterday about those two questions. So you can definitely go to the website and listen to Rick's interviews. Or, as Nick said, you can go to Ballotpedia and check out some of the language there. So thanks for those emails and calls. Again, you can join us. It's exchange@nhpr.org if you want to email. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or you can call, like Cheryl did, 1-800-892-6477. A couple more questions about the House and Senate, guys. And then I do want to turn to what I love about this series that you did, and that's the more less covered stuff, the local offices, the ballot questions, why we don't have initiatives and referenda here in New Hampshire, although our friends in Maine have tons of them. and in California, they have so many, it's hard to wade through them all. But just a little bit more on the House and Senate. Both of you mentioned this before in one of your episodes. You talk about how the midterms are an opportunity for political change, but not too much political change. So what are you trying to say there, Nick?
Well, we did this episode, What is the Difference Between the House and the Senate? And it was a great excuse. And the sort of inspiration for it was from this summer during the Wayfair emergency vote, the emergency session held by the House and Senate in New Hampshire. I watched the live cam of the Senate, and it was this beautiful, lovely staid affair of people chatting about this proposal, this bill. And then I switched over to the House cam later, and there was somebody shouting on stage, on the podium. People were shouting in the audience. Speaker was banging his gavel. And then somebody snuck up to the microphone to tell everyone about an antique automotive show at a hotel down the street. And I was like, what a lovely discrepancy between these two houses. Why are they so different? And one of the things I came away with hearing, which is maybe a bit of a Debbie Downer, the House doesn't get a lot of stuff passed. The House's job is to try to put forth as many bills as possible. Right now, it's about 9%. 9% of the bills that the House puts forward become law. The Senate's doing a little better. 15% of the bills in the Senate become law. But the voice of the people was what the founders wanted the House to be. They wanted the people to have some power.
So implicit in what you said, though, Nick, is that get stuff done is good. As you guys point out in the episode, maybe sometimes you don't want Congress to do anything. Maybe some of those bills that are introduced are bad.
I think if you think about how rapidly our world would change if our legislature were constantly passing things, it does make sense that you would want kind of an inefficient legislature. We often complain about the fact that these legislatures are so inefficient, but it kind of protects us against constantly flipping around and having new laws and having to navigate a different world order, you know, every year.
So the Senate kind of calms things down.
Yeah, the Senate is, what is it? The Senate is the cool cup that chills the tea of the hot house, you know, something like that. But yeah, the House is supposed to put as much stuff as possible, and this is what Dan Cassino said. The Senate is supposed to slow everything down. It's, you know, when we look at things like the Tea Party in the past or like the anti-Masonic Party in the 1800s, they won a ton of seats in the House of Representatives, and their only platform was to be against the Freemasons. So if that is your party platform, that's not the sort of thing you want every 2 years.
Seems rather limited.
Yeah.
Although, depending again on your perspective, sometimes you're excited that the Senate is slowing things down. Sometimes you're incredibly frustrated that the Senate is slowing things down. When folks listen to your series, they'll hear you use beautiful classical music. Sounds like a string quartet or something.
Yes, you noticed that.
For the Senate. And then there's some like party disco music for the House. So it exemplifies
it's house music,
House music. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. We'll talk a lot more after a short break. And we we've got lots of people who want their questions answered. So buckle your seatbelts, get ready, and we'll be back after a very short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Granite Staters head to the polls on Tuesday, capping off a tumultuous midterm election season. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me for live coverage of the races at the top of the ticket in New Hampshire and around the country. We'll also keep an eye on down-ticket results that could affect the balance of power in our state house. Our complete election night coverage begins at 7 Tuesday evening on NHPR and NHPR.org. This is The Exchange. Today, a midterm elections 101. NHPR's Civics 101 team is here, having just completed a series on the history, mechanics, and the broader meaning of midterms. Check out their podcast. You can find a link at nhpr.org/exchange. Also, there's a voter guide there with tons of information about registration, voter laws, and more. So if you have specifics about these midterms, go to our website. Again, it's exchange at nhpr.org or nhpr.org/exchange. But right now, we'd love your questions about how midterms work both here and in other states. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Now, earlier, folks, we talked with a woman who usually doesn't vote in midterms, but she was going to do it this time. She was a Republican. She wanted to switch to Democrat. I told her to go to the website. More broadly, we've got a lot of people calling. And to answer your question, Cheryl, and I hope you're still listening, you can vote outside your party on Election Day. In the primary, you have to pick ballot A, ballot B, ballot C for Libertarians. In the general election, you can just pick up a ballot. So, Cheryl, if you're registered, just go down and pick up a ballot and vote. If you're not registered, again, check out the website because there's a lot of resources there about registration. So I hope that clarifies it. Back to our conversation about the series that you guys produced. We talked about how the founders set up the House and Senate to kind of, how'd you put it, Nick? Cool down the hot tea.
Oh, yeah, cool down the hot tea. Yes, the cool cup that cools the tea.
What else did you really begin to appreciate, Nick, through doing this series about that inertia, that lack of change that you and Hannah talked about, and how it's kind of baked into the cake here?
Yeah, so when we talked to, he's a political correspondent, Bakari Sellers, one of the stark things that stood out to me about the Senate is its demographics. He started our interview by saying the Senate and the president are the 101 most important people in our country. And then he went on to tell me that you can count there have been 10 African-American senators in the history of the United States. Contrast that to the House of Reps right now, which is 10% African-American. If these are the people who are passing the laws and they are not, quote-unquote, representative of the people of the United States, we have to take a deeper look at that. What it takes to become a senator is a lot different than to become a representative.
And a lot of money involved and so forth, and we'll talk about that. But let's hear a little bit from Bakari Sellers, since you mentioned him, former South Carolina politician, today a lawyer and CNN commentator, and as you said, Nick, discussing the racial disparities that remain in the U.S. Senate.
It's, you can literally still count on less than two hands. But, you know, if you go back in history and you're talking about Ed Brooke and Mo Cowan and Carol Mosley Braun and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and Tim Scott, I just ran through, there may be one that I'm missing or two, but I just ran through the African-American members of the United States Senate in history. And so it's a very deliberative body. But it's also a very old white male body as well. Usually there's a sense of patriarchy that puts you in a position to run for that office.
Okay, so that's Bakari Sellers talking about the U.S. Senate. And as most listeners will know, every state gets two senators, no matter how large, no matter how small, Vermont, California, equal in the Senate. What about the House, Hannah? There's been a lot of attention to how those lines are drawn.
In terms of redistricting.
The U.S. House, yes, yes. How those lines are drawn, who gets to draw them, and so forth.
So if we're looking at what some people might call gerrymandering, the official term is congressional redistricting.
And it's not always gerrymandering.
This is something that we came up against in our reporting and research. I think it was in the middle of an interview. I said, hold on a minute. We're not using the term gerrymandering. Why is that? And that's because gerrymandering is used when this is a political move. So although it may often seem that way, it is not necessarily that way. And so every 10 years, new lines are drawn around districts that will decide basically what the voter pool is, essentially. So especially this year, you are going to be voting for people who will then be deciding what those lines are. So if we want to talk about the importance of a midterm, sometimes you're voting for the people who decide how powerful your vote actually is.
Well, and this is a big, big deal. And I'm really glad you guys spent a lot of time on this in the series. Nick, I have talked to many people, very smart people, very politically savvy people, people who always get involved, who always vote. And they're still surprised to learn that drawing political boundaries is a very political process.
Yeah.
I've heard so many people say, again, very savvy people say, wow, that doesn't seem right. You mean the same people who are voted into office get to draw the lines that will help them be voted into office? People are always surprised by that.
Yeah, well, you know, the party in power is the party who is responsible for drawing those lines. That's just the stark reality of it. And then the other stark reality is that the party in power is going to want to stay in power. That is not news, I think, to anybody in the United States.
Shocking, shocking. Political parties want to stay in power.
You know, but this the notion of gerrymandering, it has to be, it's tied to the U.S. Census, which is every 10 years. And if you've been reading the news a lot, we've got our 2020 census coming up, right? So the new lines are going to be drawn once the 2020 census comes out, and the people you are voting for senator and for rep possibly right now are going to influence how we draw those new districts. So this midterm election, this and 2020 as well, are the two big, big years for drawing congressional districts.
So if you had thought about sitting this one out, Nick,
yeah,
don't, because the state legislature in most cases ends up drawing the lines, and whoever wins the state house,
right,
in states around the country, mm-hmm, gets to draw those lines.
There are
a couple exceptions.
There are a few states who have the citizens vote on how a district should be drawn. California, no surprise, for example, is one of those. But and if you're curious about how gerrymandering works, we even have a whole episode from early on in our series on gerrymandering. And there's a great board game you can play that Arnold Schwarzenegger
played.
A board game on gerrymandering, yeah. I'm always
a sucker
for it. Well, you all get, you're all political heads, and you have to pick how districts are drawn, and whoever wins, wins. And it's the greatest way to teach gerrymandering I've ever seen.
Well, you guys talk to, again, Keith Hughes from Hip History about how these congressional districts are drawn, and as you both said, to favor existing parties, party lines that are already there, how, you know, parties try to draw these lines to their advantage, and how to the point where most political scientists say only about 40 U.S. House seats are truly up for grads. Let's hear again from Keith Hughes.
Just to put it in perspective, in the last election, it was pretty split in terms of the House of Representatives. We saw, if you took the total vote for House members, it was about 50% split between Democrats and Republicans. But when then you break that 50% down and you look at, you know, what happened in terms of the outcome of the vote, you know, the Republicans have more of a 40-seat advantage in the House.
So again, that's Keith Hughes from Hip History. And Nick, in the episode, you say, wow, I was really surprised it was that small. That
I
only 40 seats were up, truly up for grabs.
I was absolutely surprised that the same amount of people voted Republican and Democrat in that election, but the staggering number of seats went to the Republican Party, and that was due to these gerrymandered districts.
All right. Well, once the lines are drawn, Hannah, I want to ask you about who actually has the capacity to run for political office. We hear a lot about the vast sums of money needed to run. How does the need for that money, especially for higher offices, affect who runs and who doesn't for the U.S. House and Senate?
Yeah, well, you heard Nick talk about the fact that the demographics are, they're pretty white. They tend to be older. They tend to be wealthy people who are able to run. And that's because, you know, I talked to one political analyst, Leah Askarinam, who said, nothing matters if you don't have the money first. And oftentimes you start with money, you know people who have money, or you have the face recognition to get money from other sources. You have to campaign to add to your face recognition. Those campaigns cost millions of dollars. I think it was Bakari who said that, you know, if you want to run for U.S. Senate, you need to start when you're 12 years old. You need to get
12
your
years
face
old.
Up.
Wait a minute.
I mean, you know, it was an exaggeration, but basically he was saying, start raising money now, start getting your face out there now. And that often means that you are an older, wealthier white person.
So besides the money, Hannah, what else do candidates need? I mean, obviously they need money, but it isn't just money. And I'm talking about for any office, you know, Congress down to local mayor. Because, you know, you guys say in one episode, the bare necessities of campaigning are locked in your state's constitution. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, so what that means is that in order to get on the ballot, you have to abide by the rules that have been written down in your state constitution.
So you have all the money in the world, but you still got to follow those rules.
Exactly. And let's say in New Hampshire, for example, if you are running GOP or you're running Democrat, if you're running with a party, you need that party's nomination. But you also need to petition to get on the ballot. So that means getting signatures. So if you are running within a recognized party, and that varies from state to state what a recognized party actually is, you need various signatures based on how high that office is. So governor or U.S. senator is going to need, I believe it's 300 signatures in the New Hampshire ballot. But
doesn't sound like very much.
Well, it's not very much if you are running within a party. You also need to pay a small fee to get on the ballot.
Sure.
And you need to basically affirm, I am running along these party lines. However, if you are running independent or you are running with any non-recognized party,
I see.
You sometimes need thousands of signatures to get on the ballot. So I know that if you are running for governor or U.S. Senate in New Hampshire, you need 3,000 signatures, and half of those need to be from both congressional districts in the state.
Because you're running statewide.
Exactly. So you just need more people affirming. And these are, you know, these might be Congress people, but they might also just be people who you find on the street, you're holding your clipboard, you say, hey, I want to get on the ballot. Will you sign your name down? Will you get me on that ballot?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm always around town, you know, doing errands or whatever. And no one this year has asked me for a signature. I'm feeling kind of hurt now. But
well,
ahead,
I don't think
Nick.
Any independent is running against, you know, or has enough signatures to run against the governor of New Hampshire right now. If you look at other states, by contrast, Texas, you only need 500 signatures to run as an independent. And that's Texas.
Yeah,
to run
huge.
Yeah, my goodness. And California and Vermont. Vermont, if you want to run as a state senator in Vermont and you're an independent, it's only 50 signatures that you need.
Let's go to our listeners again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. More people, by the way, are calling in to talk about same-day registration and party affiliation. Again, based on Cheryl's question at the beginning of the show, people can vote for either party on their ballot. And you can register at the polls on Election Day. Also, if you need more information about how to register at the polls here in New Hampshire, head to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange to find resources about all the documents you might need to bring and where to go. So I just want to get that out there because we've gotten a lot of calls from people who want to clarify that we do have same-day registration here in New Hampshire. And again, this is not a primary. Tuesday is a midterm election. I don't want to say a general election, but it is a general election. You can pick up a ballot and vote for whoever you want on that ballot, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whoever may be there. So to clarify that, let's go to our listeners. And James is calling from Concord. Hi, James. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, so I was wondering, you guys started off the program talking about potential historic voter turnout in this midterm. And I remember reading about how in the last midterm election there was historically low turnout. And I was wondering, do you really even need to have historic turnout to make a huge impact on, for example, like a really close race? I mean, could like 5% difference in turnout for one party? Obviously, that could have a huge impact, I would think. I guess that's my question.
Yeah. James, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Nick, you want to jump in?
Sure. I mean, just like we said earlier, because of such a small number of people voting, a percentage like the one you said, James, that is enough to have a lot of change because your vote is so much stronger in a midterm election. So if you're looking at trends, if you're looking at greater and greater percentages of people voting, it can be a massive swing from such percentages.
Thanks a lot for the call, James. And here's an email from Jerry in Dover. Our congressional elections, Jerry says, need serious modifications. Currently, with two-year terms, a congressman legislates for 1 year and runs for re-election 1 year and is only 50% effective. Jerry says, I would propose that the term be raised to 4 years, with half of the state's legislative body running on alternate two-year cycles. This would result in 3 years as working as a legislator and 1 year running for re-election, a 75% rate of effectiveness. Wow, Jerry, thank you. That's very well thought out. And you guys talk about this in the series, right, Hannah, how with the Senate, The terms are staggered. They're 6 years. So senators maybe do have 4 or 5 years to just focus on policy, and then they have to kind of focus on running. But the House, no deal.
No, it's true. If you are a member of the House, you have to basically be campaigning constantly, which means that, for one thing, you are in some ways more beholden to your electorate, right? Because you are campaigning to them. You want their vote. But at the same time, you know, you're right. You are not able to focus as much on the actual legislating part of the job. And Nick talked about the fact that the Senate is this cooling body. Well, they do have more time to deliberate. They do not have to be running over and over and over again.
Go ahead, Nick.
That's basically Hannah said exactly what I was
Well, I wanted to ask you guys, I've long noted here in New Hampshire that everybody pretty much turns over every 2 years, including
right.
our governor. We're the only state besides Vermont, I
South
think.
South Carolina. Everybody has to face the music in South Carolina.
Even the governor in South Carolina?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Everybody.
So very few states have their governor up every 2 years like we do here in New Hampshire. Our legislature turns over, state House, state Senate. All these local offices, too. So that's unusual, Nick?
Yeah. Well, I'm really interested in what the listener said. Jerry said, because I am always for advocating revisiting how we do things in the United States. I always love looking at things and looking at these systems. But that 2-year term, even though it is ineffective, again, that was the goal of the founders. They wanted sort of an ineffective body to be the voice of the people because they thought the people were not a democracy. They even called it a mobocracy. So maybe ineffectiveness, while it's not appealing to people who want change, is a necessity.
Ooh, a mobocracy. That's not very nice.
It was not nice. Nobody was nice in the
Well, let's hear, actually, on that point from Dan Cassino, a political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, talking about that point, Nick, why the founders created the U.S. House of Representatives. Let's hear.
They didn't like the people at all. They even called democracy mobocracy because they didn't like the idea of the people actually running anything. The reason we have the House of Representatives is to give the people a voice, but to make sure that voice can't actually do anything. The House is supposed to be representative of the people, but as far as the founders are concerned, the people of the United States were kind of like the people of Springfield in The Simpsons.
Money!
They're ready to jump on any bandwagon with pitchforks and torches and protest against anything.
Again, that's Dan Cassino, political science professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. First time I've heard The Simpsons in the same description.
Well, I think it was high time. It was high time that NHPR had a Simpsons clip played on. Actually.
Well, we've had Simpsons clips, but not in the context of explaining, political power. I thought that was really interesting, though, guys, that the founders really didn't like the people. He's kind of blunt there.
Yeah, and this is he's quite blunt throughout most of the episode in that regard. This is the reason we have an electoral college. These are barriers between the people and the laws, because gosh, we can't trust the people. And if we do trust the people, then what could possibly happen? And this is what we'll learn about when we talk about ballot initiatives, direct democracy. What happens when we do leave it entirely up to the people? But yeah, that's what he said was in the House, it's a majority vote wins, right? In the Senate, because of the filibuster, you're going to need like a supermajority, 60%, which is usually you can't have everybody from both sides make things happen. One House staffer told me, if you're in the minority in the House, you're just getting your backside kicked up and down those aisles every single day, and it ain't fun. In the Senate, there's a little bit more of a come down from the castle and reach across the aisle, and we're going to negotiate, and we're going to maybe have beers afterwards, and we're going to get some stuff done. But you don't see that as much in the House.
All right. Well, after a short break, I really do want to talk about ballot initiatives, mm-hmm. ballot questions, referenda. They've got these in how many states? Lots of
24.
States.
24.
24. Okay, not in New Hampshire. We do have constitutional amendments on our ballot. And as was noted earlier, we have two this year. But other states, wow, their ballots are a lot longer than ours here in New Hampshire. Many, 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 many questions. So we'll talk about how those work. And we'll talk about something you mentioned earlier, Hannah, the really large importance of these smaller local offices. You make the point in the series that, you know, these choices may actually have more impact on your day-to-day life than those more sort of sexy choices of U.S. Congress and U.S. Senate. So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, the ins and outs of midterm elections, the history, the mechanics, the broader meaning. Let's get your questions in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're sitting down with NHPR's Civics 101 team. They just completed a six-part series on the midterms. Check out their podcast. You can find a link at nhpr.org/exchange. Also, we've got a voter guide there today with information about registration, polling places, voters who might have special needs or special situations. We're sitting down with Hannah McCarthy. She's a producer and co-host of Civics 101. Her co-host is Nick Capodice. He's also education outreach and engagement producer here at NHPR. And both of you, let's turn to a topic that I really, really want to talk about, and that is local offices. And Hannah McCarthy, much of the media attention, as you point out in the episode, goes to the balance of the House and the U.S. Senate and how much of the elections will be a rebuke of the president or not. But one of my favorite episodes was the one that you took the lead on, that local counts for a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that a number of people who we interviewed talked about, this fact that there's this stop sign question, right? One woman, Cheryl Cocalio, was speaking to a student of hers, and that student was saying, you know, I don't really care about this local stuff. Why should I care? And she said, well, you don't care right now, but one day you're going to be, you know, walking your kid down the street and you're going to care about whether or not there's a stop sign at the end of the street. And it's this idea that all of these local offices that you're voting on in this midterm election are the people who are impacting your day-to-day life. It's not as flashy as the president, but they are the people who are keeping the records for your home or deciding, you know, where your tax dollars are going. They are going to make your life easier or not.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Cheryl Cocalio, again, a teacher, former councilwoman, former candidate for California's State Assembly, talking about the importance of local.
Whether or not you get a stop sign at the end of your street is really dependent on the kind of city council you elect. County supervisors have control over regional issues that have to do with transportation and maybe even water. And so midterms are often ignored because there is no presidential candidate. But they may be even more important because there's such low voter turnout during a midterm election.
Again, that's Cheryl Cocalio speaking in NHPR's Civics 101 podcast series on the midterm elections. So what offices, Hannah, did you look at that sort of caught your interest? Like, oh, what does that person do? And they're up for re-election every 2 years.
Yeah, I think something that makes people kind of glaze over about the midterms is that you will see offices like Register of Deeds on the ballot and think, that's very obscure. I don't really know what that means. Well, Register of Deeds, these are the people who maintain the property records and documents of a county. So they are keeping records relating to real estate and property rights. If you want a real estate sale to go smoothly, you go to your Register of Deeds office and you get the information. You find out who owns that piece of property. There's also county attorney, the chief law enforcement officer in a county, the person who is persecuting felonies and misdemeanor appeals from district courts. But my favorite, and I actually followed a handful of sheriff's candidates in the primary, my favorite is sheriff. So a sheriff is someone who is transporting prisoners and providing security in courts, investigating crimes, apprehending criminals. And you can find all of these job descriptions in our revised statutes for New Hampshire. But one thing that I just kind of blew my mind was that a sheriff does not necessarily have to have law enforcement experience before they run for sheriff.
Really?
Yeah, we're voting this person in. They don't have to prove that they have ever, for example, held a gun before, but they will.
Made an arrest.
Exactly. They'll be making arrests. They'll be driving around in the sheriff's vehicle. So this is why it's so important to do your research on your candidates. You want to make sure that the person who you might be voting for sheriff actually knows what they're doing in a very important local role.
Well, often these races are uncontested, so that's another reason why they don't get a lot of attention.
It's true, and this is maybe a reason for people who have never really considered running before to maybe throw their hat in the ring, because there aren't often that many candidates for these smaller roles because, you know, people just aren't necessarily paying attention.
Yeah. So county register of deeds, county attorney, sheriff. Here in New Hampshire, Nick, we have the executive council.
We
now,
sure
we've talked
do.
About those a lot on the exchange, but just quick remind us who they are and what they do.
The executive council, we are the only state in the union that has an effective executive council. There are some states that have one as sort of more of like a figurehead position or sort of what's the word I'm looking for? But
Advisory body.
Well,
like
no,
that.
But so yeah, the executive council, they weigh in and they have to affirm all of the governor's picks. And this is for stuff that really matters. This is judges. In the state of New Hampshire, we do not vote for judges. In 20 other states, we do vote for judges. But judges are appointed by the governor, and then they are approved. Those appointees are approved by the executive council.
They approve contracts. They approve
contracts over, was it $10,000?
Yeah, there's a certain level.
The executive council is one of those offices that when I moved back to New Hampshire, I knew nothing about it. And then when I started researching it, I realized these are five of the most influential people in this state.
Sure. And more recently, the executive council has become a springboard to higher office, as we're seeing. Governor Sununu was an executive counselor. Chris Pappas, who's running in the first district, was an executive counselor. I always like to tell people that we don't elect judges in New Hampshire. And just reiterate what you said, Nick, because I think that's really important.
So I'll reiterate it. So
about judges.
20 states in the United States, judges are elected. In New Hampshire, judges are appointed by the office of the governor, and those appointments are approved by the executive council.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, but judges like sheriffs are people who, when you get down to in your ballot, if you're in a state that does vote for judges, they don't have a D or an R or an L next to their name.
And no party affiliation.
No party affiliation. And that's what's also really cool about these down ticket names is you have to do your research to figure out how this person weighs in on things. If this is somebody who's going to be pulling you over in a car for committing a crime, you probably want to have an idea of what their leanings are towards justice.
Mm. Well, Hannah, you and I were talking before the show this morning about this idea that judges are not elected in New Hampshire and sort of weighing some of the pros and cons around that. I mean, there's a school of thought that says, thank goodness judges aren't elected. They don't have to raise money. They don't have to sort of kowtow to certain constituencies. But then you were saying, well, maybe there's a plus side to judges being elected.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we want our judges to be unbiased. However, just like Nick just said, they might have certain views on certain topics. You might have a more liberal or more conservative judge. And if they are being appointed by a majority GOP or majority Democrat electorate, or rather legislature, then you are going to see judges who are leaning possibly more one way or another. I suppose, you know, though we may be the mobocracy, if we are able to cast a vote for a judge, you might see maybe a more diverse candidate pool of judges.
Very interesting. So not on the ballot, at least here in New Hampshire. No judges, no commissioners. And also our Secretary of State here in New Hampshire is chosen by the legislature. So even though you've been hearing a lot about, quote unquote, the race for Secretary of State, although that's not really accurate, that's going to be chosen by the New Hampshire legislature. So not on your ballot.
And it is always worth noting that we have the third largest governing body in the world. Our 400-seat House of Representatives is something that I'm sure most of your listeners are very familiar with, but it is always worth thinking about again and again.
Got an email from Christopher in Manchester who says, to reinforce what your guest said, I learned in political science that democracy is an intentionally messy process. Change is incremental and difficult and slow for a reason. Christopher says, if you want swift, rapid, dramatic change, you'll find it in dictatorial and authoritarian regimes. Wow, Christopher, thank you so much for the email.
Put.
What do you think, Nick?
I think I just want to echo what he said. That's absolutely true. It is in oligarchies and despots make change happen swiftly and immediately. When you hear people say things like, I'm going to do this right now, that's when you got to be careful and you got to say, well, watch out, because that is directly against the wishes of the founders of our beautiful architecture of our Constitution.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Christopher. Our email address, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So both of you, Civics 101, produced here in New Hampshire at NHPR. But you guys, as you've said, you're a national show. Lots of listeners all over the country, including in California. Let's talk about an aspect of midterms that's kind of fascinating for me here in the Granite State because we don't have them, and that's ballot initiatives, citizen referenda, propositions, call them what you will. Nick, what are these?
holy cow, this was my favorite thing to research.
Yeah, it was really interesting for me.
Because I knew nothing about it. And also because it spoke to the Constitution being we the people, beginning and ending with people at the end of the Bill of Rights. So a ballot initiative is when the citizens, not wanting to get something through the whole rigmarole and the pedantry of the House and the Senate, can just put forth a bill and it can be voted on by the people and if they get enough signatures. And then it becomes law. Tremendous. So 24 states have these ballot initiatives.
So, you know, a lot of states.
A lot of
Half
states.
Half the states, basically.
The ones with which you're maybe most famous are California. California has 11 on the ballot this year. It had 12 initially, but one was about sort of breaking California up into three states. So,
oh, my goodness. Wow, I haven't heard of that.
But what I didn't realize, so then the number of, you just need a bunch of signatures to get a ballot initiative to go forward. And Hannah, doesn't it sound like a good idea, right? The
Hannah
people?
Hannah had some skepticism in the episode on this. Yeah, go ahead, Hannah.
Well, it does sound like a great idea. But Nick, you know, you made the point in the episode that here's what some people may see as the downside of these ballot initiatives. People can pay people to stand out there and get signatures. And this is kind of a big business. You can make up to $5 per signature. So people are out there just, you know, they can kind of say anything to you. Unless you read that initiative, you might be putting your name to, you know, they might say, you don't want to kill puppies, right? And you'll say, no, I definitely don't want to kill puppies. Let me sign this. But, you know, the initiative might have completely different language. It might not really be about puppies. It might be about something completely different. So there's a lot of money in there. There's a lot of politics in there. And there is some misleading language that can mean that these initiatives or these propositions are not necessarily reflective of the democratic process.
Mm, so there's some big money involved in promoting these. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's not just the citizens who have a great idea. Hey, golly gee, should we do this in our state? It's often corporations who have tons of money who can pay millions and millions of dollars to pay out-of-work actors and restaurant workers to go out in the streets of California and to just, hey, try to get as many signatures as possible in the election season. That's how they get on the ballot.
Yeah, I feel kind of sad when I hear you say that because the image, Nick, is, you know, civically engaged grassroots neighbors who coach Little League and run the Girl Scout troop, like, you know.
There is that, too. And I don't mean to come off as cynical about ballot initiatives. It's just I can't help it after talking to these political correspondents. Also, you know, that's how they get on the ballot. Another thing that just absolutely blew my mind was that sometimes people put things on the ballot as an initiative with no intention of backing it once it's on the ballot.
Oh, let's talk about that a little bit. That was really interesting. And you guys talked to KQED's San Francisco political correspondent, Guy Marzorati. He said what you just said, Nick, sometimes ballot initiatives aren't really about the issue at hand. It's about increasing voter turnout among certain voter groups. Let's hear from him.
Ballot initiatives sometimes are often just used to get people out to the polls. I mean, we saw an example of that this year in California with the gas tax repeal. This was a measure placed on the ballot with heavy funding from the state Republican Party. They spent a lot to get the signatures and get it qualified for the ballot, but then stopped spending as much once the measure actually qualified. And the reason was they really wanted this gas tax repeal on the ballot to get Republicans to the polls. They thought it would be a big driver of turnout. That would help them in the governor's race and even more importantly, help them in really close congressional races. But as an actual measure, they didn't really fund it once it was on the ballot to the same extent, which made it seem like maybe it was more important to get it on there than to actually get it passed.
That's KQED political correspondent Guy Marzorati explaining what you said, Nick, that, you know, sometimes it's about the issue, but sometimes it's just about encouraging certain groups of people to go to the polls.
It doesn't matter about, you know, whether or not that initiative goes through. Everybody cares about how much they're paying at the pump for gas, right? So that's going to get tons of voter turnout, specifically from the GOP. And once that person's in the booth, they're going to vote for that person for governor and for state rep.
Go ahead, Hannah.
I will just say one thing against the cynicism that's kind of built into this. Because, you know, I am with you. I also felt that sense of cynicism. But, you know, a layperson, a regular person, a person who doesn't have millions of dollars, it is possible for that person in certain states to propose an initiative. And if you get enough of a grassroots movement around you, people signing their name to your petition, you can get something on the ballot. And that is kind of a beautiful way that the people can have their voice heard in certain states.
So how come New Hampshire doesn't do this, Nick?
Oh, well, New Hampshire's constitution was written too early.
Too early.
Yeah, if your constitution, I forget
the
exact year.
The early bird didn't get the worm.
But basically, if your state constitution was written during the progressive era, you're going to have ballot initiative referendum.
I see. But since we're one of the originals.
But you know, New Hampshire famously doesn't like tweaking its constitution. Let's revisit our 400-seat legislature. But the other states like Maine and Massachusetts, even though they have early constitutions, they have revisited and they've decided to adopt referendum recall initiative.
Let's take one more question, both of you. Heidi is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Heidi. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've voted before for president, like, a bunch of times, but this is going to be my first time voting ever, like, during the midterm. And the things that have put me off in the past, I know. I'm very right?
So I'm like, no judgment, Heidi.
Okay. So the main issue that I've always found is been really hard for me to find what people's platforms are, like what each person that I have an opportunity to vote for, like where they stand on certain issues. So I was wondering if you guys could kind of speak to, like, you know, a one-shot-all kind of, like, click here and see everybody, what they're all about, and that way I can inform myself better.
Oh, Heidi, I'm so glad you called and glad you're voting in the midterm. So, Hannah, let's talk about this. Heidi's right. There's a lot to know. Where do you guys go to better inform yourselves about the midterms?
Yeah, our number one stop is Ballotpedia. That's where you can find. So that's Ballotpedia. Is it .org, .com?
.org.
And if you go to that website, you can search for your state and you can see everything that's on the ballot. And while you might not be able to get everybody's platform from that website, that is the place to go to find out, you know, if these are the candidates I'm interested in, I'm now going to go to their websites and I'm going to do a quick read maybe, or a long deep dive if that's possible. And then you can walk into the polls and feel like you're informed. But Ballotpedia.org.
And New Hampshire specific citizenscount.org is a tremendous keeper of how everybody's voted in the past, how they will vote in the future, hypothetically, and where they stand on every issue. You got to research these people before you get into the booth.
Well, and the issues, too. We got a question earlier from a listener about the constitutional questions here in New Hampshire. I would also direct listeners to nhpr.org/exchange. Our producer, Christina Phillips, is, as we speak, busily putting links up to all of the resources that you guys mentioned, in addition to the resources she put up before today's show. I have a bunch more questions, but we've run out of time. It was really great talking to you guys. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Laura. It was a blast.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Nick Capodice and Hannah McCarthy. They are the co-hosts of NHPR's Civics 101 podcast. It's our refresher course on our democracy. And they just completed a 6-part series specifically on the midterms. I really encourage you to check it out. If you're not sure how to do that, go again to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.